This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Fox Nomad Podcast. I'm your host, Fox Nomad Anil Polat. My guest today is Dr. Luke Kemp. He is a researcher at the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge and an author here to talk about his latest book, Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Societal Collapse. We're talking about how humans have gone from egalitarian societies to where we are now in our current modern world and some of the things that cause a lot of the dysfunction that we see. We talk about imbalances, we talk about human nature, we talk about the future and what's headed down the road. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation with Dr. Luke Kemp. Thank you, Luke, for joining the podcast. I found an article about you very interesting because every time I open the news lately, I feel like the world is headed toward societal collapse, which you know, a thing or two about. What got you thinking about basically the end of modern society? is there a better way to put that?
That's pretty good wording. First of all, thank you for having me on the podcast. And hopefully this can be informative, but not too doom-laden. I don't want people depressed by the end of it. What got me thinking about collapse initially was working on climate change. So I was a lecturer in climate change science and policy back at the Australian National University, the ANU. And I was teaching a course called Climate Change Science and Policy. And by the end, the students were always dreadfully depressed for obvious reasons. And we tried to give them some more uplifting lectures, one on protest movements and the other on technical solutions, in particular something called solar geoengineering, where you essentially fire up particles which cool the atmosphere by reflecting sunlight, aerosols they're called. And by looking into that, that became my gateway drug into thinking about how other things could go wrong. Not just climate change. Climate change could, of course, be highly destructive, but even this solution could backfire in spectacular ways. And that got me then thinking about nuclear weapons, for instance. And even if we decarbonize the entire world by 2050, if we achieve that Herculean task, but we have a nuclear war in 2051, we're still unfortunately screwed. So I started thinking about existential risk in general. And part of this is also just a realization that even when it comes to climate change, we're not doing a very good job. Geopolitically, we seem deadlocked and incapable of actually doing what's necessary at a global level. And that's unfortunately true for many of the problems we face.
Yeah, it does seem like we are just kind of cruising on into a great unknown, where in the sense that we don't have as a species a good plan for what's going to happen, even though we know what's coming down the road, right? We just keep kind of putting it off, it seems like. And there's also seems to be this pressure that's kind of increasing just around the world. At least that's how it feels. So you mentioned, you know, in your book, you mentioned that there are these certain elements that cause us to kind of go in this direction as a society, but that, you know, human beings are sort of innately egalitarian, at least in smaller groups or smaller. Is that right? And what takes us, like, how do we start at one place and then get to where we're this Goliaths everywhere.
So I start the book by looking at what's called the Paleolithic, the recurrent ice ages we evolved in. So humans have been around for approximately 300,000 years, and for the vast majority of that time, until roughly 12,000 years ago, we were in the Paleolithic. And this is a pretty dangerous time. There were 86 active volcanoes across Africa. The world was around about 5 degrees cooler, and ice sheets covered roughly a third of the Earth. It wasn't an easy time to survive, which is why we survived, and yet at least eight other hominid species, so Homo neanderthalensis and Denisovans, the Floriensis, they all died out. So we're pretty unique. And what always struck me as odd was this idea that if we were really quite violent and we weren't good at cooperating and we tended to fall into mass panic whenever there was a big disaster, that's not a very good evolutionary recipe for surviving. Quite to the contrary, that's a really easy way to die out quite quickly. And when you look at the actual evidence, the anthropological and ecological evidence, it paints a very different picture to what most people think. Most people do think that when we face disaster, we tend to become engaged in a big scramble for resources, what's often called a Hobbesian state of nature, named after the 17th century philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who thought that without states or without kings and authority structures, life for us was nasty, brutish, and short. And that's not quite true. When you look at it, there's no signs of inequality, so we seem to be egalitarian. We lived in groups that range between kind of 40 to 200 people, but the groups were quite metropolitan. So amongst modern nomadic egalitarian foragers, roughly only 10% of people are closely related. So these aren't ragtag groups of families. They're actually quite multicultural. And while you could be part of a small group, you'd actually move across groups quite frequently across your lifetime. And that has two big effects. One is that it means the individual could actually know thousands of people across their lives. So we often get enamored by this idea of the Dunbar number, that we can only know roughly 150 people, and that kind of caps our cooperation. It's not quite true. Again, we can kind of update and change the people we know over time. And secondly, that this creates very big webs of cooperation. When you look at Africa roughly 120,000 years ago, we had evidence of shared lithics, so stone tools, musical instruments, genes, and culture all the way from the East Coast to the West Coast of Africa. And that's partially enabled by the fact that we are pretty nonviolent as well. The best genetic and archaeological evidence suggests that during that period, we had roughly a 1.3 to 2% lethal violence rate. In other words, for every 100 people, only roughly 1.3 to 2 people would die at the hands of another human, which is about as safe as the modern world, potentially even a bit safer. And that was more or less our state of nature, the way in which we evolved for almost 300,000 years. And then things begin to change.
And is it agriculture that kind of kicks that off, that where we're able to have bigger groups, or is there something else is it merely a function of larger groups, or is there something else that's happening to us?
Agriculture is part of the story, and it's always been the traditional story, right? So even both Marx and Adam Smith pointed towards agriculture as being the key ingredient behind the creation of empires, kingdoms, states, etc. Agriculture is useful, but it doesn't tell the full story. So both Papua New Guinea and Egypt had agriculture at the same time, roughly 7,000 years ago. Papua New Guinea never develops pharaohs. They never build pyramids, for instance. They look very different. And the key thing here is not agriculture, but the type of crop you're growing. In Egypt, they're growing wheat. In Papua New Guinea, they're growing banana and taro. Bananas and taro are very different to wheat. So bananas, for instance, you can only store them for roughly a month after they're ripe. And in the case of taro, you can only store them for roughly 6 months. And importantly, you can also leave them in the ground for a longer period of time. So it's very difficult to see them and know where they are, and they don't know exactly when they'll be harvested. Wheat has one very clear harvest period, which it advertises through high stalks, and it can be stored for decades at a time. And when you look across the world, there's 10 different centers of independent food production where we had agriculture, and four of those developed states. They developed the world's very first empires and kingdoms. the key thing is that the ones which do develop these empires and kingdoms, they have resources which are easily seen, stolen, and stored, what I call lootable resources. In particular, wheat, rice, and maize, or corn. But importantly, you don't need to just have agriculture. So we have hunter-gatherers become much more hierarchical. They start to develop things like patriarchy, slavery, warfare, and they do it on the basis of smoked fish. So they have these big runs of salmon, for instance, which they catch and smoke, and that becomes a resource that you can easily see, you can easily store, and can, of course, be stolen from masses. It's a bit more complicated than that. You tend to not only see it happen when you have lootable resources, but also when you have certain kinds of weapons that can be monopolized by one group. So, for instance, in the Near East, we had the world's very first kingdoms in the case of the first dynasty of Egypt and Uruk in the Near East, in Mesopotamia. And those only occur not when you get wheat, but actually once you get bronze, handheld axes and swords. So they're pretty clear image emerging here, which is you have a certain resource which people depend upon, which can be taken, and the people who have the weaponry to do so start to develop a kind of almost organized crime syndicate of sorts, which is how skulls have often referred to as states, that they're almost like an organized crime racket. There's a last ingredient alongside little resources, monopolizable weapons, which is caged land. And most of these original cradles of civilization, as people often call them, it tends to be in areas which are quite caged off. For instance, Mesopotamia means the land between two rivers in Greek, and Egypt is buffered between the Nile and the Red Sea. In short, people couldn't move either. So if an organized crime syndicate started popping up, they couldn't easily escape. The overarching picture here is not one of civilization, the typical way we think of it, as better technology and civilized conduct. Civilization comes from the term civilis in Latin, which has these connotations of virtue, political wisdom, restraint, moderation. Instead, in these first states, we tend to see mass human sacrifice, warfare, patriarchy. What's really changing here is we start to organize ourselves into dominance hierarchies, where one individual or a small group is ranked above everyone else and usually enforces rules through violence. In short, we start looking less like ourselves and much more like the hierarchies of chimpanzees and the harems of gorillas. I call it evolutionary backsliding, and it's a very different picture of how we typically think of history.
Yeah, because normally we just, at least my perception is, you know, in the past, you know, or you know, it's everyone for themselves. It was this very cutthroat type of situation where everybody's fighting for the last bit of resources, which are very scarce. I mean, this is just kind of the, I guess, the perception that people have. But it seems like for the majority of our history, it wasn't like that at all. But it's when these balances start shifting, right? When one group has more than the other, that's when we run into problems.
Precisely. And there's a reason we have that vision. And it's a very common one. If you look at, say, for instance, Mad Max or The Road, any kind of apocalyptic fiction, it always paints the same story of as soon as you strip away the thin veneer of civilization, we turn on each other. And it's even pretty prevalent in disaster risk planning. Some people have this idea of mass panic, for instance. And yet, when you actually look at the studies, it's pretty clear that mass panic is a myth. When it comes to studies of, say, for instance, tsunamis, hurricanes, earthquakes, even terrorist attacks, people are pretty good at self-organizing and were pretty altruistic in the worst of times. There's a really good case of during 9/11.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first stepfather, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
So obviously the terrorist attacks in New York City. Directly afterwards, there's the world's largest evacuation over the water. What's called the boat lift. Basically, people move a huge number of people from Manhattan across the Hudson. And that's more or less just the Coast Guard putting out a call and everyone just self-organizing from there. And again, if we just reacted through panic and a scramble for resources, things would look very different. And we wouldn't have survived the Ice Age in the first place. The reason we tend to have this narrative is partially because it serves the interests of some very powerful people. So obviously it's usually attached to Thomas Hobbes, but interestingly, this idea that we're pretty bad without having rulers is around for thousands of years. There's Buddhist texts, for instance, which talk about how we live in this kind of primordial chaos until eventually people all elect one leader who is the most good-looking, charismatic, and well-spoken, which usually isn't a very good selection mechanism. And they will give this leader a piece of rice in exchange for him essentially taking over and starting to ostracize people and dole out punishments. There's songs from Zhao-era Chinese history as well, thousands of years ago. So this is something which didn't begin with Hobbes. It's a story which has been around for a long period of time, and it's a story we see very clearly in Claps. Almost all the kind of literature we have in history from Claps paints it as being this apocalyptic thing. Once again, telling the idea that if we don't have rulers, we kill each other. And again, when you look at the evidence, that just doesn't seem to be the case.
And is that why when things get worse, there are two things. One, there seem to be leaders emerge or people in power emerge who say, or who tend to show, you need me, I can help us. And then also at the same time, why do groups of people, why do societies want that? What is the, there seems to be something that we fall into at certain times, or is that just perception, or is, you know, is there sort of a natural, you know, thing that we're falling into?
No, I think you're completely right. There is a trap of sorts we fall into. I think we often fall into a really false dichotomy of either humans are really good or we're really bad. And of course, the reality is a bit more mixed. While I think we are in general pretty decent, kind, and altruistic, we have what I call in the book the darker angels of our nature. And one of the most important is that all of us desire status. That's the desire to be admired, respected, valued by others. And there's two ways to achieve status. One is through prestige, by giving benefits to the group, and the other is through domination, by essentially imposing costs and violence upon others. And when you look at the history books, the vast majority of people remember Genghis Khan, Napoleon, etc. They basically achieved status through domination, through violence. And there's only a very small number of people who want status to a really big extent and who are willing to take it through force. It tends to be overwhelmingly men, and it also tends to be people who are higher in what's called the dark triad, which is Machiavellianism, the ability and desire to manipulate others for personal gain, psychopathy, callousness and a lack of empathy, and narcissism, an overinflated sense of self. And those three tend to result in people who are much more willing to take status through domination. There's also, of course, the fact that people who are pretty good and pretty decent and competent often get into power, but then seem to change. And we have a good literature now on what's called power corrupting. And through multiple social psychology experiments, it does seem that when people get put into positions of power, they tend to have less empathy, less compassion. They're more likely to cheat both in games and on their spouses. They have less risk aversion, and it seems to even change their brain. It in particularly inhibits their ability to do mirroring, which is basically where we start to copy each other's mannerisms as a way to build rapport. So people who are empowered tend to do less of that. So those are the three darker angels of nature: dark triad, power corrupting, and the desire for status through domination. And those explain why it tends to be only a certain number of people who are willing to go to great extents to get leadership positions, and it's often not the best people who do so. But as you mentioned, it's a question of why do we accept that situation? If we're naturally egalitarian, why is it that we end up in these Goliaths? And this is where the authoritarian impulse, as I call it, becomes important. We know pretty well now that when people feel threatened, they're more likely to become authoritarian, to want to obey high status, high authority individuals. You see this pretty clearly throughout recent history. Putin rises in political stature as the Chechen bombings occur. There's just a load of different despots throughout history who have usually framed either Jewish people or migrants as some kind of scapegoat in order to create an enemy so they can basically come sweeping in as a strongman leader. And it does seem like, and multiple studies suggest this, that when people feel threatened, they also tend to prefer leaders who have more masculine features and are actually taller as well. So threats change our brains and they change the kind of leaders we want. They change our values. And when you look at the very first states, they all occur after you get warfare. So once you get the first signs of warfare, usually in a couple of hundreds or thousands of years, you start to get the first kingdoms popping up, which paints a pretty compelling story that once people felt threatened, they were much more likely to give their freedoms to this collection of dominant hierarchies that I call a Goliath.
And that sounds like how you mentioned how sort of chimpanzee groups tend to work, as a norm. Why do we regress that? In other words, if egalitarian is our base, why is there would seem there would be a counterbalance to that, maybe, perhaps, or do the leaders really just work quite a bit to make sure that those elements don't come together?
There often was a counterbalance. So, throughout most of human history, there were, of course, people who wanted to dominate groups, who still wanted status. And what you see in modern day nomadic egalitarian hunter gatherers is what we call counter dominant strategies. So, people who try to dominate a group are usually either ridiculed, ostracized, kicked out of the group, or in the very worst cases, they're executed by the rest of the group. And in many ways, you can see some of the collapses of the first farming communities and cities as actually being kind of scaled up versions of these counter dominant strategies. So, it's often difficult to tell because we don't have written records, but in many of the first farming communities across Europe, for instance, and the US Southwest, it seems like once you get the first signs of inequality, you start to get sometimes mass flight and sometimes mass rebellion, and often warfare as well. And many of the first cities across the world as well, I go through a whole bunch of these in the book, like San Lorenzo, Şadolhöyük in modern day Turkey, Montauban in Mesoamerica. They also seem to go through a period where they're basically building up and eventually start to become more unequal. You start to see rulers emerge. And then suddenly they start to fall apart, often, once again, by people either just walking away or by having a kind of mass revolution, which in which they intentionally target both elites and elite iconography and monuments. And in some ways, that's that kind of counter-dominance intuition shining through. It shows that for many people, it wasn't very easy to move into conditions of servitude and oppression. And while that's true, I think that we did have this pretty big reaction quite frequently. It's also true that most states kept popping back up. And of course, we live in states and empires today as well that have taken over the world. And that's in part because I think that rulers and bureaucracies tend to be pretty good at actually evolving over time and developing new techniques, technologies, and ideas to control larger groups of people. And this varies from having, for instance, administrators and bureaucracies, which help if the king has to go away, for instance, all the way through to actually having religions and what I call stories of subjugation. It's pretty remarkable that when you look at when you look at states, kingdoms, and empires across the world, they all tend to have stories which basically justify why the ruler's in charge. The pharaoh, for instance, is either a god or a representative of god. In the medieval ages, we have this idea of the divine chain of command or divine chain of being, where basically there's God, the angels, the king, and everyone else below, more or less, usually going through the nobles. The Chinese had the mandate of heaven that essentially we can reflect the order of heaven if we have an emperor who also acts in good conduct that reflects heaven. But in every single one of these cases, they're used as a way, a propaganda tool, if you will, to justify why the leader is in charge. And of course, we don't actually have any good evidence just that the pharaohs or Chinese emperors were actually working on behalf of gods or were even particularly good decision makers. But a lot of people believed at the time that they were.
Yeah, it's interesting because it brings up this quote that I had read from The Dog Whisperer, right? In one of his books about training dogs. And he said, humans are the only animal that follows a weak leader, which I don't know if that's generally true, but it always stuck with me that thing where it's like when you're in a small group, I imagine hunter-gatherer, if you're not pulling, you know, doing your part and you get ostracized, you get kicked out of the group, that could be a death sentence. Right. But if you're, you know, a mayor of a city and you're doing a terrible job, the chance of you remaining there or even getting wealthier seems, you know, it could easily happen. You know, it's not necessarily, there's not a complete, you know, A to B to that. So it seems like we go through these cycles in history where things get very bad. There's a revolution, a war. And then things get better for a time, and then we repeat it a couple generations later. Is that correct? And how do we get out of that? Because it does seem like we are in another cycle. The feeling. I don't know if it's true, but I feel like we're in this cycle and we're heading toward a not good place.
First of all, on the issue of weak leaders, I think there's an element of truth there. In nomadic egalitarians, they tend to have what's called task-based leadership, which is you can have a leader in certain areas of life, in certain tasks, who are particularly good at that task. So, you know, a hunter who's actually good will lead the hunter usually. But it doesn't mean they'll basically be in charge of everyone else in other areas of life. That doesn't really make sense. We tend to have that weird situation, right, where you have someone who seems to be in charge of almost every area of life. And often, as you mentioned, we don't have good evidence that they actually are good at their job. And I think Nassim Taleb calls this the inverse rule. The higher you work up a hierarchy, if you look at a CEO, for instance, it's actually really hard to tell if they're doing a good job. Even if the company's doing really well, that can often be due to other circumstances, due to the wider geostrategic condition. It could be due to the fact that the actual workers are really working really hard. And likewise, investment bankers and financiers, we don't actually have any good quantitative evidence that they perform better than the market. And yet they get paid the big bucks. So there is this kind of weird distinction between often performance and power. And importantly, the other way which we're very different to other species is that we can inherit status and power. You don't have that happen in chimpanzees or gorillas, but in our case, we can basically hand on power and, of course, thrones to the next generation. And it's notable that every single billionaire under the age of 30 today inherited their wealth. So it still happens. It's cycles. Do we go through cycles of rise and fall, of collapse? To some extent, yes. It's, of course, not as simple as there just being these clear-cut cycles of very distinct period, but it does seem like there's a particular pattern here. And one is that we know over time inequality tends to increase. This is due to two big reasons. One is simply that the powerful tend to have more opportunities to gather more wealth. If you are sufficiently rich, you can start to buy office, you can start to lobby politicians, and of course, you can start to transfer your power into other domains. You can start to buy your own military, for instance. You can start to potentially buy up priests, etc. And that all provides new sources of power, potentially new sources of money. And secondly is just simply that things like land and today stocks and shares tend to increase more quickly in value than wages do. It's something that Thomas Piketty's talking about quite a lot. Inequality doesn't tend to reverse until you have what Walter Scheidel, a professor of classics at Stanford, calls a great leveler. A bloody revolution, a mass pandemic, mass mobilization warfare, or a state collapse. And what I put forward in the book is that rising inequality and the fact that it tends to spill over into other areas of life, making, say, for instance, politics more concentrated, more likely to become dictatorial, that makes societies more fragile over time. And we have a lot of good evidence for this. For instance, societies that are more unequal just tend to, by nature, be more prone to violence. They tend to have a higher rates of environmental pollution and even higher rates of, weirdly enough, things like teenage pregnancy. In general, inequality causes a lot of social friction and social corrosion, which makes sense for a species that was evolved in conditions of equality. There's other knock-on effects here. Peter Turchin, a very well-known historian, has written about this idea that once you start to get growing inequality, you start to get a bigger and bigger elite class who have to compete for resources and have to compete for status. And you start to also have a transfer of wealth from the bottom classes to the top. As things like land become more expensive and you start to get a bigger elite class demanding more and more, basically the poor get poorer. It spurs, if you will, a cost of living crisis, which is something we see across history, but of course we feel today as well. And that combination of increasingly marginalized poor people and elites who are looking to find more power is essentially a kind of powder keg for social combustion. And on top of that, once you start to get a larger, more concentrated group of elites, they tend to make worse decisions. In general, people who are pretty homogenous and are buffered from the consequences of their actions aren't going to be making good decisions. In short, oligarchies worse than democracy when it comes to decision-making. We have good studies for this. And additionally, if you're competing for status and more resources and power, it's going to push you to both expand the empire, resulting in imperial overexpansion. As you conquer further afield, you tend to get less resources, you have to expend more. But also you tend to get environmental degradation as well. And if you look at a case study like the Western Roman Empire, it has all those factors at play. It's both stripping its silver mines to such an extent that it has to debase the currency, it has to use less silver in the currency. It's massively overexpanded and has a really bloated military by the end. And it's also incredibly unequal by the end of the empire. Roughly 3/4 of the way towards the maximum theoretical level of inequality. And the maximum in this case is a situation in which one individual holds all the surplus wealth. So Rome, despite the Colosseum and all the cool ruins, actually wasn't a great place to live for most people. And that basically makes for a very fragile society, which is eventually split apart and knocked asunder by some kind of hazard, something like a disease, climatic change, invaders, sometimes a combination of all three. And that's something we see over and over again. I call it diminishing returns on extraction, one form of Goliath's curse. Goliaths are cursed insofar as they're built in equality, but inequality ends up being their demise.
Interesting, because one thing that has gone through my mind, you know, thinking about and reading about the ideas that you put forth is that the leaders now have much more power, much more, you know, data, much more, you know, more dangerous weapons. The climate crisis is growing, whereas Rome, you know, those are more, right, smaller climate issues that they would have. But these things are on a global scale now. And I guess one of my questions or concerns, I guess, is do the leaders ever figure it out? In other words, do they ever maintain that balance to where the people just never, that we just never get out of it until basically, you know, everything really falls apart? I mean, is that where we're headed, or where are some of the bright spots going forward?
Yeah. So there's been periods in history where we've had reform, which has resulted in some kind of decreasing inequality and a kind of venting of these pressures. One example is during the 1930s and 40s in the US. We obviously had this Gilded Age, a period of robber barons and tycoons and oil, steel, etc. And the US actually put in place a whole bunch of measures, including things like legislation which encourages much higher unionization rates, much bigger benefits for union membership. And in some cases, this was actually acquiesced to or even supported by the rich. They kind of started to realize that it wasn't in their interest to have such unequal societies. It's a more complex story insofar as this was also aided by the world wars. So the world war basically result in what many scholars call a great compression. In short, so much capital and land was destroyed that the rich lost much more. But also because there was this mass mobilization warfare of so many people involved, that they started to demand more from their states. They started to demand welfare, a social security net, the vote, etc. And you see directly afterwards, of course, the rise of liberal democracies and welfare states. So that's one example where things seem to have gotten better. Another is Athenian democracy. So basically, Athens has a very unique democratic structure where essentially, rather than electing officials, and interestingly, the Greeks actually compared or found that they always linked electing and voting to aristocracy. And to them, democracy was about random selection. And that's what they did. When Athenian democracy was at its height, it actually had a large group of citizens who were randomly selected from different parts of the polis to basically run an assembly. And they had also large-scale assemblies alongside of that. Sortition was the basis for Greek democracy. And it seemed to have worked pretty well, and in some cases, they even had other mechanisms to help quell status competition and keep a lid on inequality. One is that if you were past a certain threshold of riches, you had to maintain a warship for the Athenian Navy. And that became a way in which elites competed. They basically see who could have the cooler warship in many ways, but they're also providing a public good as well. But notably, in all these cases where they've had reform to help reduce inequality and help reduce these pressures of extraction, it doesn't tend to last long, and it doesn't tend to actually reverse inequality in a lasting fashion. And I think you're right that while historically collapse has often been a good thing, you know, if you look at both the fall of the West Roman Empire, even the late Bronze Age, people seem to get taller and healthier afterwards. And this isn't a simple story of, oh, so many people die and so many people move that, of course, they get taller because the survivors have more resources. Even people on the outside of the Roman Empire tended to be taller and healthier. So the old myth, or the old trope, I should say, of the German barbarian being muscle-bound is actually kind of true. In the future, it's likely to be far worse for a couple of reasons. One, as you mentioned, we're now in a global single Goliath rather than having these kind of regional empires. The second is we have much worse weapons. Collapse does unfortunately tend to result in a spasm of violence as groups of armed young men try to recreate the state, to try to create a new Goliath. And now, rather than having access to bows and arrows and swords, they have access to nuclear weapons and potentially killer robots. And last but not least, we're just far more dependent upon global supply chains and elite infrastructure than ever before. It was quite easy for a Roman peasant to just take up more farming or even adopt a bit more hunting and gathering. Most of us can't easily do that now. And on top of that, states now are actually often a good thing. You know, I wouldn't want to live in the West Roman Empire, but Denmark's actually pretty decent. Denmark's not a bad place to live. The state actually does a lot for its citizens. And hence, if the state falls apart now, it actually will be a bad thing.
So you had a quote where you said you're pessimistic about the future, but optimistic about humanity. Where do you see, so for, let's say somebody who's 20 years old now, this is a broad question. I mean, it depends on where they are in the world and so on, but what does the future look like for their adulthood? I mean, and what could they do? I mean, is this inevitable that we are headed toward a major collapse?
It is not inevitable. The future is always open and probabilistic. And while this has been a 5,000 year long process, and I think it'll be very difficult to stop and to overturn, it is possible. What will the future look like? Of course, caveats, it depends upon who you are, where you are, and the future is not locked in stone. But I think the most likely trajectory at this stage is, first of all, we'll be living in a world which will likely have less democracy and less freedom. We already see mass surveillance becoming more widespread across the world. Even the most ardent democracies, like in the UK or the US, they're spending at least 100 times more on facial recognition and improving mass surveillance than they are upon improving their democracy, improving voter turnout, doing more deliberate democratic experiments. That's what you call revealed preferences. They're through money and expenditure showing what they really want. And across the world, we already see a lot of democratic backsliding. The numbers, I think, are roughly, there's 40 or more countries that are turning more autocratic every year, and less than 17 that are turning more democratic. And already today, roughly 5.7 billion people live in autocracies, not democracies. And I expect that to grow over time, including in places like the US. We're also likely to live in a more dangerous world in some regards. We might have some more material possessions, but the world will be heating up. I wouldn't be surprised if we resort to solar geoengineering. So once again, pumping up coolants into the atmosphere to offset the effects of warming. We'll likely have wars that are fought by robots rather than people. And the downside there being that they'll be more efficient, more ruthless, and more directly under the control of leaders. And we'll also likely see nuclear stockpiles increasing once again, which is already happening. Whether a global catastrophe will occur is uncertain. I would say it's more likely than not over the space of the coming century. And collapse will be a very real prospect over the coming decades and centuries. In the book, I put forward the idea of the end game, that right now we're entering the very final stage of Goliath, where essentially it either has to take complete control and create what I call Silicon Goliath, or it's likely going to undergo a large-scale global cataclysm and collapse. That might not be next year, might not be even a few decades, but at least within the next two centuries or so, that's the most likely course, is a self-termination.
And does that mean for societies, or, you know, the extinction of humanity in a nuclear war or something like that?
Extinction, I think, is very unlikely. It's a very high bar. We are a remarkably resilient species. We can survive in almost any kind of environment. There are scenarios I can imagine in which humans go extinct, but they're going to be a very unfortunate and lethal combination of different threats and vulnerabilities. So, for instance, if we have a global thermonuclear war where both the US and Russia use their entire stockpiles, that could, at least by the most recent models, result in 5 billion people dead. That's mainly due to the knock-on effects of what's called nuclear winter, where if you bomb a city, it starts shooting up soot into the atmosphere. That soot is a particle which reflects sunlight, and it basically creates a winter-like condition across the Earth for up to a decade. You also get other effects. Nuclear weapons that go off release what's called an electromagnetic pulse, which basically fries electrical infrastructure. And you'll likely have a huge number of people and animals moving, and they'll have compromised immune systems, resulting in probably more disease. If you have that, and then directly afterwards, you have big disease outbreaks and potentially also a surging in the climate. So you have, for instance, a geoengineering system, you have a nuclear war that knocks it off. And then afterwards, after nuclear winter, you have a kind of a nuclear summer of sorts, where there's a big rebound in temperatures. That might be enough to kill us all off. I think the idea of human extinction for now is very unlikely. It's going to require just such an extraordinary combination of threats that I wouldn't be thinking too much about that. But it's not off the cards. It's not off the table.
So I have two, I guess, final questions for you. The first is, what does the average person do? Can the average person do anything about this? Is it inevitable? Is it like throwing a stone into the ocean and waiting, you know, sort of to fill it up? You know, is there something tangible also that people could feel like they're having an impact?
Yes. I think that this is not a matter of all hope being lost. There's certainly hope, and there are actions that individuals can do. First of all, it's worth noting that all of these threats have pretty clear solutions. We know how to decarbonize the economy. Nuclear weapons and lethal autonomous weapons, killer robots, we can just ban them as well. That's just a very easy path forward. If you're really worried about AI and improving algorithms, just don't build them. All these things can be done that require far better regulation. And I think one of the most promising ways forward here is by trying to rebalance power, in particular political power. I'm a very big fan of this form of democracy where you work through citizens' assemblies and citizens' juries, where you basically randomly select citizens and have them make decisions. There's emerging evidence they tend to result in less polarization, better decision making and more risk aversion as well. So for most people, I'd say get politically active, vote for people who are more likely to move us towards actual genuine democracy, and vote for people who are promising things like citizen assemblies and citizens' juries. If you're contacted for things like jury duty or for an experiment in citizen assemblies, take it up. And also in the book, I've put forward the idea of don't be a dick, which is pretty simple. It's that these big power structures, even though we can use terms like Goliath, they're not really ethereal. They're made up of people, and they're made up of people making very particular choices. And you don't have to contribute to that. If you're someone who works in machine learning, for instance, you don't have to go work for an AI lab like Anthropic, DeepMind, or OpenAI. I'm sure they offer a very good paycheck, but is it worthwhile given what we know about their operations, that they're, first of all, aware of the damages they're causing? They directly cover it up and try to veto regulation like SB 1047 of California. And they're potentially building machines that they themselves, the very CEOs, think could destroy the world. You don't have to contribute to that, and you shouldn't contribute to that either. And the same goes for arms manufacturers in the fossil fuel industry. You know, ExxonMobil knew about climate change back in the 1970s and 80s. They did their own modeling, which was surprisingly accurate, and they intentionally buried the information and ran disinformation campaigns to cast doubt on the science of climate change. People, just pure and simple, should not contribute to that. We shouldn't encourage bad behavior, if you will. And on top of that, just don't accept positions and relationships of domination in your own personal life. Goliath, in many ways, is fractal. You know, it's not just the fact that we have these big empires, but also that we accept domination all the way down. Schools, our personal relationships, relationship between boss and worker, etc. We can make these things much more equal. We can share power. And if you have power, do try to share it. Do try to make sure it's more like civilization, less like life. So those would be some of the small actions ones can take. Be political, support actions and parties which are actually moving towards deliberative democracy, and try to make sure that you're not being a Goliath, not giving in to dark angels of your nature.
Well, those are, I mean, it's sort of, you know, when you said nuclear weapons, we can denuclearize. And I was thinking, well, if one side does, right, then the others, they may worry, or the population may worry, right, that the other side isn't. But that's where it, my brain connected, that's where the cooperation comes in, right? Like you all sides have to work together, in other words, otherwise there's that equality again, which then causes the opposite effect.
Yeah, so when it comes to doing most of these things, like reducing emissions or reducing nuclear weapon stockpiles, the obvious response is, but game theory. If I do it, the other party's just going to screw me over. And I think this is actually one of the most important issues I put forward in the book, is that ultimately this isn't about AI or climate change or even nuclear weapons. It's about what's driving us to produce them. And some of the clearest things which are arms races, races for status, and races for resources. But it's worthwhile noting, it's not just everyday people who tend to end up in these arms races. You've probably heard the tragedy of the commons, this idea that if you have a common resource which everyone can access, eventually it will be overdegraded because everyone has an incentive to use it and no one's basically willing to cooperate to prevent overuse. The thing is, when you actually put people in laboratory experiments and game theory dilemmas, they don't tend to end up in arms races. And even if you just let them communicate, they don't tend to end up in a tragedy of the commons. Similarly, we have loads of examples across history of peace systems and groups that have lived in their environment without over-degrading it for hundreds of thousands of years, like the Khoisan people in the Kalahari Desert. It's quite clear that this isn't something that all humans do. It's something which, in particular, Goliaths do. I put forward in the book that both people in the Dark Triad, who are higher in the Dark Triad, tend to be more likely to defect and to result in kind of arms races, but also people who expect others to do so, people who are usually trained in finance and economics. It ends up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. But the key thing here is, if we can actually reform our societies from the bottom up and make them more democratic, I think there's very good reason to believe that we won't fall into these types of dilemmas any longer. I'll probably finish with one little story, which people always seem to like, which is the idea of the Trinity Jury. The world's very first atomic weapon was detonated in the sands of New Mexico in July 1945. It was called the Trinity Test. At the time, And this was the outcome of what's called the Manhattan Project in the United States. At the time, we knew the Nazis were no longer pursuing their own bomb. They couldn't build their own nuclear weapon. So this wasn't about beating the Nazis to the bomb. And the physicist Edward Teller on the Manhattan Project made a calculation that there was a non-zero probability that detonating the bomb could ignite the entire atmosphere of Earth, killing every single shred of life, not just human extinction, but leaving the entire planet silent, potentially the entire cosmos silent. They still went ahead and took that risk and detonated the bomb. And I give the example of, imagine that we went back to 1945. Instead of that decision being made by generals and scientists, it was instead made by a group of randomly selected and chosen people from across the United States, farmers, doctors, nurses, cleaners. What do you think they would have decided?
That's a definite no, right?
I've yet to meet one person. Yeah, exactly. I've yet to meet one person who hasn't said some variation of either no or fuck no. It's just pretty obvious. And exactly the same if you had in the 1970s, groups of citizens sitting over ExxonMobil, they wouldn't have said, yeah, you know what, bury the information on climate change and run those misinformation campaigns. That's fine. I think when we actually trust ourselves and we trust democracy, things work out pretty well. And additionally, it's going to make for a much safer world. And that's the true way to overcome these things like arms races, is by a reversion back towards democracy. It won't be easy. It's going to be incredibly difficult. It's probably going to be the hardest thing that we as a species have ever done, but it'll be worth it. And most importantly, it is possible and it's worth fighting for.
Well, I appreciate your time. Let people know where they can find the book when it's out. I will leave links to it down in the description, but I'll let you share more about, you know, release date and everything as well.
Yep. So it's actually being released in North America today. So both US and Canada, it's now released in all bookshops and online sellers available to you. And it's been released in both Europe and the UK for the last few months. So it should be readily available. And I usually encourage people to try to use local independent bookstores if they can, but it should be available for anywhere, whether it be Amazon or Waterstones back in the UK.
And the book is Goliath's Curse.
Yes. And the book is Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Societal Collapse.
It's been a fascinating conversation. I'll give you one more yes and no, just a real quick one that I've been thinking yep. about. So in science fiction and Star Trek in particular, mm-hmm. we're in this societal collapse and aliens show up and then everyone realizes, oh, we're actually not all that different from each other. Mm-hmm. Would that happen? In other words, would that propel people to realize, or would it just create different inequality? I mean, does the inequality problem just not go away in a hypothetical?
It depends on what the aliens are like, if they're threatening or not, what kind of information they impart to us. But I think, unfortunately, I don't see that being a solve to inequality. It probably gives us a greater sense of coherence and connection, but you can have very connected people who still have very authoritarian structures.
Interesting. Well, that gives us a lot to think about. Thank you again so much for your time. I this has been a fascinating conversation. And I look forward to sharing the book and everybody reading it, because it gives us a lot to think about, especially every day, every second when we open the news, it seems like.
Yeah, it's unfortunately becoming more relevant, but I hope that isn't always the case. And thank you for having me as well.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Kemp, for being a guest on the podcast, and thank all of you for listening. Make sure that you check out Dr. Kemp's book, Goliath's Curse. I will leave a link to it down in the description, or go to your local independent bookstore where you can also find it. I think if you enjoyed this conversation, you're really going to enjoy the book. Thank you all for watching and listening. If you're on YouTube, make sure that you give this video a like and hit the subscribe button. And if you're listening to the audio, wherever you get your podcast from, make sure that you give the Fox Nomad podcast a 5-star rating and a couple of kind words in the review. It helps us get the word out. Thank you again for listening and watching, and I'll see you in the next episode.